Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the New Books Network podcast in Ukrainian Studies. I'm your host, John Shethichka. Joining me today is author and writer Megan Buskey, who will speak with me about her recent book that is titled Ukraine is Not Dead Yet, A Family Story of Exile and Return. The book was published in 2023 by Ibidem Verlag Press. Megan, thanks for joining me today on New Books Network. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Megan, I want to start by asking you actually about your motivations for writing this book. It's sort of based around the story of your grandmother, Anna, and her extended family as they really traversed the turbulent events of the 20th century in Ukraine, particularly in Staryava, but also outside of Ukraine, in Russia, in Siberia, in the Gulag. Throughout the Soviet Union, Germany, and then, of course, in the United States, where your book also takes place and where you're from. And the story that you tell unfolds, I think, is remarkable. And it's one that gives us an intimate view of displacement, of war, of collaboration, of migration, and the family networks and the intricacies of all these things that you tell along the way. And I'm sort of struck by it because much of what you write about are really sensitive and difficult topics that not everyone would want to share or make public. And I want to ask, with that in mind, what compelled you to dig into your family's history? And then after digging, why did you decide to write a book about it?
That's a really wonderful way to phrase and frame all of the things in the book. So I really appreciate that. The initial impetus for the book was really my relationship and my closeness with my grandmother. So I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. It was the place that my grandmother and mother had come to after leaving the Soviet Union in the late 1960s. I grew up kind of on the fringes of the Ukrainian diaspora. I certainly went to Ukrainian church, went to Ukrainian school for a few years, ate more than my fair share of pierogies. And was exposed to a lot of different Ukrainian cultural or features of Ukrainian cultural life. But I wasn't really my mother, who had come from the Soviet Union, wasn't a particular partisan of Ukrainian culture. It was more my grandmother. And so I didn't have as intense a diaspora upbringing, I think, as some Ukrainian Americans do. But I was very close to my grandmother regardless. And she was, she lived very close by. She watched me and my younger brothers on a weekly basis. And she was a really caring, dependable, loving presence in my life. But also someone that was obviously very different from everyone else I knew. I grew up otherwise, apart from the sort of Ukrainian cultural exposure I had from my grandmother. I grew up in a very American environment, very middle class, Midwestern, suburban. And so the culture she represented was quite foreign and exotic to me, which was, as a child, I resented quite a bit because I didn't, want to go to church. I wanted to hang out and play Nintendo or play soccer or whatever. But as I got older, that the richness of that became more interesting. But another thing was my grandmother was like a bit of a mystery to me. I mean, she had very obviously experienced something very difficult in her early life in Ukraine and the former Soviet Union. And that came out in a number of ways in my childhood, just sort of seeing how carefully she was always managing like food and money, how seriously she took work. Like she would never, ever, ever take a sick day, for example. Like that was just something that my mother is the same way. And then she would also too, like she had these memories that she would share with us. And some of them were obviously just so, so dramatic about war, about her time in Siberia. And they were kind of from a different world, from a different era, but also very painful. It was clear to her. And she would, you know, start to cry on occasions when she was talking about these things. And I think as a person who loved her, that the reasons for all of that were very interesting to me, were very compelling to me. And it was one of the things that, it was that sort of, that mystery that drove me, I think, initially to become much more committed to understanding my Ukrainian heritage. Something that made my background a little bit different, again, from like, maybe like the Ukrainian diaspora that was established in the, like in the, after the war, for example, was that we still had a lot of close family in Ukraine. So I grew up knowing that I had aunts in Ukraine, that I had cousins, second cousins, etc. And there was this notion of there being these close relations, but there was also this distance. Like we couldn't talk to them because it was the 80s or the early 90s. Communication was very difficult. And there was always this sense of there was this other part of the family that was missing. And I think that that was also really intriguing to me. And it was the mystery of all of that that sort of led me to Ukraine in the first place, wanting to unpack that, know that better. But it, even that was like slightly different than just undertaking this project, which I didn't undertake until maybe 10 years after I had first started going to Ukraine. And it was really brought about by my grandmother's death. She died in 2013. And I felt just this intense need to preserve my memories of her, preserve what I knew of her life, which I had known to be so extraordinary. And, you know, to document it for myself and for my own family. And I think that was kind of where I started to do the writing and then really started to do the research. I think it was really kind of a way, it was a way to mourn my grandmother, a way to stay close to her when she was gone, because I was learning these new things about her life. And it was almost like we were continuing to have a relationship even though she was gone. And that was really important to me. But then the research also sort of got its own life. And there was a lot that I found out about her life and also people that were close to her that was not necessarily what I set out to find. But I did find it. And then once I started to see all of these pieces coming together, I felt like it was a really interesting story and that it could say something about what the Ukrainian experience was like, you know, particularly before and after, or before, during, and after World War II, but about the 20th century more broadly. And I felt that by packaging all of that together, it could be helpful for people to try to wrap their minds around what the Ukrainian experience was like through the lens of just one family. So that's when I started to think about it as a book project that could have more value outside of just something that would be for, you know, my family purposes or personal reasons.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I think that's an amazing way to describe it, because I, you know, talking about writing this as actually like some form of catharsis as well, to remember your grandmother. And I, you know, I love all the stories and anecdotes that you tell about her throughout the book. And, you know, the frugalness is something that also, you know, sticks out to me of, you know, my own family, you know, my grandmother's, you know, from You know, they were Czech, but still, you know, always having something on the table, you know, giving you loaves of bread in your fridge, and, you know, always taking care of you in those sort of maternal ways. I like all those anecdotes, and, you know, they sort of at the same time hide a very dark history that you navigate as you go through this. And your grandmother passes away in 2013. And then, of course, 2013, 2014 in Ukraine are monumental years with Euromaidan, Revolution of Dignity. And so you're sort of, you know, it to me, it was really interesting that, you know, you're sort of caught between this Americanness that you're growing up in Cleveland. And then there's this Ukrainian identity, which you said, you know, you're sort of on the fringes of, you know, the diaspora. And, you know, it's something I'm familiar with myself in the Czech context. And I know, I think that's, it makes sense to me that you'd want to go to Ukraine, and that sort of offers some answers to that side of the family that you hadn't explored. Which brings me to sort of my next query, which is, so you get this interest to go to Ukraine and you start going there, you learn Ukrainian, and you know, like you said, you had family there. And I'm curious, what was it like when you started going to Ukraine and visiting your relatives in places like Staryava and, you know, these other little villages that a family member of you kindly, was it Vasil maybe, who was driving you all over? You, he was a very patient man who drove you to all these different places around the notoriously bad Ukrainian roads, which, you know, here in Michigan is also trying to give Ukraine a run for its money on those bad roads. But, you know, what was it like to go to Ukraine and visit these family members? And, you know, did you feel some sense of connection to Ukraine when you got there? Did it feel like you were getting closer to whatever it is that you were after? Or was it also unsettling in any way? Or was it all those things?
Yeah, I would say it was all of those things. I mean, I went, you know, to sort of answer these family questions that kind of started to vex me. But I mean, part of what certainly kept me coming back to Ukraine over and over again for so many years now is just that Ukraine is a fascinating place. And I quickly fell in love with it on its own terms in ways that don't really have anything necessarily to do with my family. But I think it's, I've always found it to be just this laboratory of, you know, a society in the middle of a huge transition, like coming out of the, you know, the end of the Soviet Union, trying to kind of come to terms with the failures of the Soviet Union, but also trying to also remember what was achieved and accomplished during that period. I mean, that's, that in and of itself is a tremendous task. And I think in Ukraine is probably the one where it's been the most fraught, where those, where that, that dialogue between what was achieved during the Soviet Union versus what failed was the sharpest. And so even just seeing that kind of play out in, you know, in the lives of people I knew in Ukrainian politics, which have for many years now have had this sort of Shakespearean cast. I mean, you know, Zelensky is like by no means like the first captivating Ukrainian politician. I mean, there were many before him. And so I sort of actually got my own political education from watching Ukrainian politics unfold. I happened to end up in Ukraine during the Orange Revolution, and so was able to witness that tremendous event. And it was the first time that politics really seemed alive to me and had real stakes. I mean, that came from a relatively sheltered and privileged position, but it was so engrossing. And so I have always found Ukraine to just be just, again, just so fascinating on its own terms. But I think in terms of what I felt like when I first arrived there, I felt, yeah, very uncomfortable. I was not well traveled at all. I'd barely been to Europe. When I first started going to Ukraine, I was like 21, I think. And I was not prepared for the degree of difference between American and Ukrainian culture. I wasn't ready for the degree of poverty that was still very evident in the early aughts in Ukraine. And to see it just sort of so clearly in the lives of, you know, my family and my friends. I also felt just a lot of, it was very powerful to be there because I felt like I was coming as a representative of my family from the United States. I was coming as a representative of my mother and grandmother, who my Ukrainian family had lost due to emigration and leaving the Soviet Union was a really serious undertaking. I mean, you were basically cut off from communication with, it was very difficult to communicate once that happened. There was really no prospect of being able to go back. And so when my grandmother and mother had left in the 1960s, they really thought that there was a good chance they were saying goodbye to their close loved ones for the rest of their lives. And to come as their emissary was extremely powerful for my Ukrainian family and was very powerful to me too. There was a way in which I was very conscious of the fact that my presence was, I don't know exactly how to say it, that I was sort of, that my presence there and like my, I guess that just that there were much bigger forces at play than just my desire to go to Ukraine, that, you know, being able to reverse this exile that my mother, my grandmother had experienced by coming to the United States was really kind of a way of, I don't know, like changing the course of history in some way. I guess that sounds like way too dramatic, but I just could feel that I was just part of this much, much bigger story. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it totally does. And I mean, it's sort of an unfair question in a way, because, you know, how you feel when you go somewhere is totally overwhelming, particularly like when you're out of your own country, I think. And, you know, as someone now, you've been to Ukraine so many times, you know, it's like a second home. And it's just, you know, I think that for me, it's a second home too, but it doesn't always make going to that home easy. And it is, Ukraine can be that sort of intimidating force of history that hits you when you land. There's a lot that there's, especially, you know, if you've read the books on it, and obviously you have, you know, you cite a number of good historians in this book and you've talked to them, but there's a lot sort of processing that goes into recognizing what you're walking into in a place like Ukraine. You know, it's, I like the way that you talk about it in your book of like, you know, I think you just called it a labyrinth a while ago, or a laboratory. And, you know, it is, it's not just one thing. And that's what makes it so enticing, but so complicated. And so I totally understand what you mean by that of like, there's just a swirl of emotions and feelings that go into this. And, you know, I can grasp that from your writing and your book about confronting these different people that, you know, you've never met before. And some of them that, you know, your family that's older than you in the US probably hadn't met or hadn't seen at least in a long time. I mean, I love this anecdote where you go to Andriy's house and, you know, he's, nobody would think it was your grandmother married to him?
Yeah, that's my, Andriy is my grandfather. So.
Okay, he's your grandfather. And there's, by the way, there's a very helpful family tree at the beginning of this book, which I found myself referencing all the time to keep track of it. But you go to, you know, his house and you sort of show up, and when you get there, he's on a walk and somebody goes to get him. And then, you know, you tell the story of what it was like to meet him, but you didn't want to tell your mother about meeting him because you were afraid, you know, of like what they might say about it. And then you sort of go through all these histories with your family of, you know, was he a good man? That you sort of go through these paths that you do, not just with him, but, you know, with others as well that are involved. And, you know, I think that's, you just do this in a way where you talk about all these different family members and who they are and trying to construct them as people and as identities, you know, that you understand. And I think all of that goes into when you arrive in Ukraine and you have to go through all these emotional things to sort of get there. So I really thought that was wonderful. Something else I also think is really wonderful about this book is, although you are not necessarily a historian, you play a historian in this book. And, you know, I'm struck by the way that you gain access to information and people. And some of it obviously is helpful because they're your family, so they'll talk to you and you can do things like do oral interviews, it sounds like, and, you know, record these things. but you also take on the very monumental task of going to Ukrainian archives. And I was sort of chuckling to myself when I was reading, you know, your experiences and let's call them trials and tribulations of working in Ukrainian bureaucracy. You go looking for clues and answers to these gaps in your family history. And, you know, for those who are going to listen to this or are listening to this and haven't actually worked in Ukrainian archives, they are a treat. Some of my favorite people in the world are the archivists in Ukraine, but the bureaucracy can be insane. And you have to put in file orders and they'll tell you that things don't exist, but they do. And you have to wait weeks. And you talk about doing some of these things to access files to your family members, particularly with regard to Stefan Mazur, who is a main character at one point in your book. So first of all, I just applaud that you went into the archives and were doing this kind of work because it's not easy. But I think it's interesting that when you get into the archives and you sort of talk about, you know, accessing information, not only from the Ukrainian archives, but from the ones in Poland, also, you know, you reference Yad Vashem and you work at the Holocaust Museum in DC, you sort of put together all these pieces and you're able to sort of locate these files on your grandmother's brother, Stefan. And what you find, I think, is quite interesting is that in the middle of sort of World War II in the 1940s, he's in the middle of all this between the Germans and the Soviets. And you find out that he's part of the Ukrainian insurgent army, you know, part of UPA. And you write a really powerful passage in sort of the latter part of your book. And if you don't mind, I just want to quote it because it sort of knocked me back a little bit. The way that you are interrogating your own feelings about confronting your family's history in a very complicated time in Ukraine's history is something that I find it sort of brave that you were able to share this and write this. And so I just want to quote it here and then ask you about it. So you write, quote, and this is after you've looked at the files you've received on Stefan. You say, regardless, the file did show that, as I suspected, Stefan had played one of the critical roles in the Ukrainian police during the Holocaust, arresting people and sending them to concentration camps. The file showed that he did this faithfully and repeatedly. How many times had he marched someone onto a train bound for Auschwitz or Sobibor? How many people had he hunted? Now, this passage, when I read it, I just kept thinking how difficult that must have been to A, confront, and then B, write, because nobody wants to have to find these things out about their family. But one thing that I think is quite admirable of you to do is to write these things in your book. There are lots of these moments in Ukrainian history that people do not want to confront. They don't want to talk about these. And I'm wondering if you can sort of tell us what it was like to confront this history and understand your family's, you know, sort of place in it. I guess I'm curious if you could talk more about how you felt as you sort of, you know, you talk about getting files from these archives at different moments, you know, after traveling to Ukraine and then you get back and you have family members and friends who are sending photocopies to you and you're sort of piecing this together as you go. And it's very difficult, but you find out this information and in a very contested moment in Ukraine's history. I mean, this is something that is still to this day relevant in many ways. You know, and this is a moment that there's a Soviet occupation and then a German occupation and a Soviet occupation again, and these things get raveled up very quickly. But of course, you know, there have been now lots of texts and books written on UPA and OUN. And you talk to some of the great historians that work on these, such as, you know, Jared McBride and John Paul Himka. And, you know, these are very contested histories, as you know, but I find it brave and entirely admirable that you're able to write a passage like that and state that my family member was in this and took part in this. What was that like to do that?
So, yeah, there's so much in that question. I think, you know, just in terms of like how I ended up sort of approaching this history, I got very interested, you know, with my grandmother had a very sort of specific experience, but as a woman, like her exposure to the horrors of the war was more limited. She was exposed to plenty that was terrible, much more than I will ever know in my life. But I became very interested in sort of the men that were close to her. So I looked very carefully at the lives of her first husband, whose name was Josep, her second husband, who was my grandfather, Andri, and then her brother, Stefan. And all of these men were, you know, born around the same time in like the either the late teens or the 1920s. So they were kind of young adults when the war started. And they were all involved in violence in some way during the war, but were you know, perpetrators of violence, but were also victims. And I was very interested in that, just that complexity. And to me, I think it was just the way that these stories felt the most human. It couldn't make sense to me that a person could be in these particularly difficult circumstances, like not have to make a bad choice, I guess. But Stefan in particular was very interesting to me because he was such an important figure to my grandmother. You know, when I was growing up, there was this portrait of him in her house. He looked so young, so handsome, so kind of upstanding. He had died, it was clear, in connection to the war. And it was his death, I think, that kind of brought about the most sorrow in my grandmother when she would speak about her early memories. And, you know, there was a sense that he had died tragically and in ways maybe that she didn't quite understand or that, you know, weren't clear. And so as I, you know, started to really research her life, I became really interested in trying to understand what had happened to Stefan. And one of the first kind of most important early clues I got was that I think within like a couple of months after my grandmother died, I was just like Googling around as one does. And, you know, I was Googling in like different languages, just sort of like looking around to see what I could find. And I was Googling about Stefan, and in English. And I was just putting in some keywords, and I found this, I clicked on a link and it took me to an entry at Yad Vashem's library. And there was a photo of a man that was wearing a uniform, and it said Stefan Mazur, a Ukrainian war criminal. And the man in the photo looked similar to my grandmother's brother, but there was not enough like identifying information. There was, you know, no way to know much about this person, or who this person was, but it was a very big flag. But then I was also thinking like Stefan Mazur is actually a pretty common name, you know, it's not that unique. And so I was like, there's a lot of probably blonde Stefan Mazurs, that were in Ukraine at that time. But it was still a flag, and I could feel it in my gut that there was something that I needed to pursue, around that. And so, I did do, like, as you pointed out, like a ton of archival research. I had, I really enjoyed it. I want to give a shout out to the Ukrainian archives for, especially as a foreigner, I was able to make, you know, so many requests, and they were responded to so diligently and in such a professional fashion. It was actually quite better than the work that I was doing with some of the American archives, where you would like send a request and just like never hear and just like lose track, not sure what happened with the request. So especially after 2015 and, you know, the opening up of the secret police archives, it became much, much easier to access this information in Ukraine. And I really benefited from that, though I did plenty of work in person too, with the help of relatives. But to get back to Stefan, yeah, I did find, you know, the incriminating information that I got about him was via archives. And to answer your question of what it felt like to get the confirmation of this to get the confirmation of, you know, in his case that he had been a member of the Ukrainian police under the Nazis, which was a terrible thing to be involved in. It was directly, you know, involved in rounding people up, sending them to concentration camps. In there, I found a file in which he was accused, this sort of war crime accusation had to do with him shooting somebody that he was supposed to arrest and take to Auschwitz. And actually the man escaped and survived. So he was outwitted. But there was, I guess, the notion that he shot at the person instead of, I don't know, if just trying to take the person peacefully. I'm not sure. I actually never really figured out kind of what the conditions of the war crime accusation were. And in any case, it ended up being closed in Poland because I guess there wasn't sufficient interest on the part of the Polish government to pursue it. And he had, by that point, in any case, had been like dead for 20 years, Stefan. But in terms of this question of like what it felt like to find out this information, it was incredibly sad. I think especially because I had known so much from my grandmother, like what a loving, caring person he had been to her. And to think that, you know, his promise and these capacities were twisted or were lost in the middle of this war was incredibly like, again, the word that just comes to mind is sad. And I think it was also, and I think of these, that photo of him as a young man before any of these atrocities took place. And I think about like the life that he could have had and most likely would have had if like the war had not happened in that region. And I just feel this an ache for him. But then I also think about, you know, I try to imagine the faces of the people that he enacted some violence towards. And, you know, another part, I also look very carefully at his record as a member of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists. He was in the ESPE, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, which was another really, really bad thing to be involved in, and was essentially accused of being part of a group of men that killed Ukrainian civilians, including women and children. And I think about like the faces of those children. I don't know who they were. I don't have visual faces, but I when I think of the sadness of what the loss of Stefan's promise, I also feel like it's really important to think about the consequences of the violence that he enacted to. And I don't know the way to kind of resolve the tensions of those feelings. I don't think that there's an easy way to do it. Like this is not easy work. It's not supposed to be simple. Like it's not supposed to be clear necessarily. And that my motive as a writer was not necessarily to provide ultimate resolution to what the tensions of of both of those ideas. But I do think that it is important, and I totally agree with you. It is so important to state it and to say this is what happened, and to own up, and I mean not own up to it, but to recognize everything that kind of happened in Ukraine during the 20th century, including like the roles that, you know, my family played in that.
Yeah, no, I mean, thank you for that. And it's, I mean, I can only imagine how emotional it is. And I think that, again, I'll say it again, I think the word that comes to mind for me is just, it's brave to do this. And I'm grateful that you did it, because this is, you know, the period that you write about in this book is one of the most complex in the 20th century, really. And I think, if anything, it's a reminder that people are never just one thing, that people have multiple identities. And, you know, it's good to explore these and know what happened and sort of live in truth, right? And I think it's remarkable. Like, it's not something that should go unnoticed. And the fact that you were willing to stake, you know, your family in there and blatantly write about these things without giving sort of a diagnosis or a resolve, but just admitting that it happened, is a really important first step. And I think something that I'd like to see more people, you know, be able to do. And it's just extraordinary because, you know, your story could have, you could have written this book without telling that story. You know, no one would have known, but you didn't do that. And I just think that's remarkable. So I know it's very difficult to talk about, but I wanted to point it out because I think your book does what it speaks to, the silences that so many others are not willing to engage in. So, you know, sort of thinking about, you talk a lot about the history in your book and the personal, and you bring these together a lot. I was wondering, you know, this, from what I understand, started out as your MFA thesis. This book, at Goucher, is that right? Goucher College? Yeah. So I'm wondering if you could talk about, I guess I'm curious to know, actually, was this always going to be as historical as it was, or as personal as it was? Did it start out in a different way? And I'm curious if you could just talk about sort of how it evolved from your original, you know, conception of this when you were writing it for an MFA, and then sort of how you thought it needed to be changed or adapted, or how it needed to evolve to get into what is now your book.
Yeah, well, I think I actually initially would have loved to have done it as kind of more of a straight history, because I do love the history. I think that is clear in the writing. And I loved the research. And if I could have created a narrative that would have had sufficient fullness, I think I would have liked to have done that. But the thing is, like, with these kinds of stories, you're never going to be able to know enough. And you could do it, but I didn't feel like I would be able to know enough to be able to, like, just sort of take myself out of the narrative as the organizing thread and just sort of tell this story from a third person perspective. And so it was kind of the gaps necessitated that I bring myself into the story. So it wasn't really necessarily intended to be kind of like a memoir, which is somewhat how it feels. But I would also say that, like, part of my, you know, impetus in wanting to do this was to really reckon on a, you know, personal level and on a historical level with these gaps and, you know, with these silences and my family story and Ukrainian history in general. And that was sort of a personal undertaking. So maybe I would have had to have inserted myself into it in some way, regardless, just because of the depth with which I really wanted to engage with those questions. I think there's something else I wanted to say about your question, but I forget what the other thing was. It's a thesis. Revisions. No, I can't remember it. Sorry. I might remember it again.
No, it's fine. It's fine. I was just curious, you know, of these things always adapt, and I'm sure you envisioned it sort of one way and then expanded on it in difference. And it was, I mean, I thought it was really great to see the personal and historical intertwined. It reads well, it's accessible. And I'm sure that was intended on your part as well.
Yeah. I will say, like, one thing that I ended up leaving out, which I now regret, is that I had planned a chapter more towards the end, which was like kind of a fuller look at kind of the Ukrainian efforts to kind of remember this difficult past currently. And I get into that a little bit, but I've spent time with a number of, like, really remarkable Ukrainian historians and kind of activists, an art curator in one case, who are doing such interesting work around trying to think very carefully about how Ukraine should be talking about this past. And I had a lot of material drafted, and I ended up not including it in part just because I needed to sort of wrap up the book, and it was just sort of like a timeline issue. But I do regret that, because I think the memory culture in Ukraine is really interesting. I think it's really being changed. I don't know if it's being changed, but it's in a very different position now because of the war. And than it was when I was writing this book, for the most part. Like, the discussion around, you know, the complexities of Ukrainian history is pretty fraught right now. And the number one reason being that the way that Putin instrumentalizes, you know, Ukrainian kind of collaboration with the Nazis, other kind of aspects of its history that are difficult. The fact that he uses those things in such a way makes it very difficult to talk about those things without starting to feel like maybe you're giving him some credentials, or, you know, giving him some support. And that's something that has been somewhat difficult for me as I've been thinking about bringing this book out into the public. But I also think that, you know, the truth is never really convenient. And I also think that, like, nuance is always a good thing. The solution to that problem is not to not talk about it, basically. That's for sure. I don't know what the solution is, but it's not to, like, shut up and not saying anything. But that said, there is, you know, there is a particular, this is a very specific moment to be talking about these things that's somewhat problematic. I don't like how I said any of that right now, but.
No, I think you said it well. I mean, it's a fair point, right? You know, we've learned a lot of things about Putin throughout this war. And one thing is that he's a terrible historian. He likes to pretend that he knows history well, but he doesn't. And you're exactly right. There are things from the past that are in conversation right now, but they're also abused heavily and, you know, cherry-picked and changed. And so it is difficult, right? How do we talk about it without giving him something? These are conversations, and it's good to be aware of that. But, you know, I think nonetheless you do a good job with it. You know, and speaking of sort of how you conceived this book, I wanted to ask you actually about the book's title, Ukraine Is Not Dead Yet, which of course comes straight out of Ukraine's national anthem, you know, based on the poem written by Pavlo Chubinsky in 1862. Why did you decide to use this for the title of your book? And is it supposed to give us, is there some symbolic meaning that we should take from it, do you think?
Yeah, it operates on multiple levels, and as does the subtitle, which is A Family Story of Exile and Return. So, you know, when I titled the book this, it was before the invasion started, and unfortunately, like, it didn't feel like very true to life. It felt like this question of, like, Ukraine, you know, Ukraine sovereignty, for example, like, well, how could it be disputed? Unfortunately, now it has a very literal resonance, which is meaningful. So it does have that read, but it was meant to also function on a sort of symbolic level in terms of, you know, expressing, you know, the role that I had in sort of keeping Ukraine, this connection to Ukraine, alive in my family. So this notion of coming to the United States and leaving behind this, you know, the country of origin, you know, it was a statement that encapsulated the fact that, like, that connection wasn't broken for me. And then it was also kind of a reference to my grandmother's experience in Ukraine and the way in which Ukraine never left her, even though she ended up leaving Ukraine when she was 22, when she was deported to Siberia. Her early experience in Ukraine was so formative to her, her being in, I think, good and bad ways. I also wanted to, I also felt like the title encapsulated that as well. And then the subtitle to this notion of exile and return refers to the number of characters in the book that experience this sort of distance from some place or some kind of family group, but then also is able to return to it in some way. And there's a lot of instances of that across the book in terms of, you know, my grandparents being deported to Siberia from Ukraine, my grandmother and my mother coming to the United States and sort of leaving behind the Soviet Union, the fact that my great-grandfather had actually come to the United States before World War II and was always essentially living in exile. And it was only when my grandmother came to the United States that she was able to like return to this family structure of knowing her father, who she had last seen when she was 4 years old. She didn't see him between the ages of 4 and I think 41 or 42. So there's a lot of really powerful moments of you know, exile and return. And unfortunately, this continues to the present day. And there's, you know, in the book, there is some discussion of like what the consequences of the current invasion have been for my family, including the fact that some of them did leave Ukraine as refugees in the early months of the war, and what it was like to kind of have experienced that family separation, which is unfortunately so common in Ukrainian history or recent Ukrainian history. So the subtitle is also meant to kind of operate on multiple levels as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's great. I love that you have a history for the subtitle as well. You know, these things are really powerful. And I suspect it as such. You talk a little bit about Ukraine is not dead yet in sort of the conclusion of your book and give us, you know, some things to think about. And it does resonate with the current moment. And that's actually where I sort of want to finish today is I just want to ask you kind of about the relationship between your book and this current war. And, you know, despite all of the things that your family went through in the 20th century, despite all of the, you know, the horrific things that you write about in your book, to me, I also found a lot of hope and determination. And I sort of want to, you know, conclude on a happy note because, you know, we don't always get to do that when we're writing about Ukrainian topics, but there's a lot of love and a lot of happiness in Ukraine, more so than bad, I would argue, of course. But I think something that sticks out to me, and speaking of your title, is when I finished reading the book, I couldn't stop thinking about the concept of resilience. And I, in many ways, like that's what I think your book is about for me. That's what it came down to of people go on. Sometimes history forces you to go on, but people are resilient. I think about your family that was in Siberia, and then you tell these little great anecdotes of they're flying on the plane to the United States for the first time and they try soda for the very first time. And the flight attendants are sort of doting on them because, you know, they don't speak any English. And these young girls are just having a great time and learning about different things in the world, and people persevere. And so, I mean, you talk about the war, you actually start the book talking about February, 2022, and you end the book talking sort of about the war and your family. And you talk about a family member of yours, a cousin, Natalia, who ends up having to leave Ukraine with her kids and separates from her husband. He stays behind, of course, but helps them get on a train and they go to Italy, and you end up going to Italy to meet with them and, you know, see them and check in on them. And again, you know, her story is like, it resonates for so many Ukrainians right now that have to pick up their lives and their family members and leave. And they're making these impossible choices that you talk about throughout your whole book. So I just want to finish by asking you, I want to ask you what lessons you think we can take from your book and your family's story as we sort of think about the future of Ukraine. You know, what do we carry with us from the resilience and going through hardships, but also overcoming these hardships? To me, your book speaks volumes about how people do this. And I'm sort of wondering, you know, what lessons you think your book offers for us as we look forward for Ukraine, as we sort of hope for, you know, this war to come to an end as soon as possible, and then also for, you know, prosperity in Ukraine afterwards. Do you have any words on that?
Yeah, I think one thing that I've observed, and, you know, as you're saying that, and I think about just, you know, in my own family, like kind of like how, like, kind of hardworking people were. And I think about, you know, like talking to my Ukrainian relatives now, and, you know, a lot of them with the electricity attacks and so on, there's a lot of inconvenience, to say the least, in Ukraine, in every single part of Ukraine. But there's not like I don't hear them complain. And there's like a real commitment to trying to like live kind of as fully as possible, despite the setbacks, despite the hardship. And also a lot of ingenuousness, which I think is kind of a hallmark of Ukrainian culture. Like, I was talking to my cousin's daughters a few weeks ago, and they were showing me like this alternative lighting structure or infrastructure that their dad had set up for them. So like whenever the lights go out, they just kind of like hit this like switch on the wall, and there's all of this battery powered light, and they can just kind of carry on per usual. And I think that that's really beautiful. I think it exists side by side with a lot of suffering for every Ukrainian right now. And I think it's important not to lose sight of that, of the psychological stress of living in a country that's under so much strain, where everyone knows someone who's fighting, everyone knows someone who's been killed or has lost their homes or whatever. I mean, just it's unrelenting, I think, from what I observe from afar. But it's, you know, along with this real sort of unwavering commitment to living as fully as possible, as I've experienced it, or as I've observed it. And I would say, like, on the topic of resilience in my own family, I think I had like this really kind of this remarkable experience going back so and sort of tracing the lives of these people so closely. In some cases, felt like I got to know them quite well, despite maybe never even really knowing them, like my great grandparents or my great grandfather Mihailo, who I mentioned before, who had come to the United States before World War II and was here throughout the whole war, watched as like his community got swallowed up, his family was swallowed up by the war. And he didn't know, I think, for very long stretches of time what their fates were. And yet he was so devoted to this idea of trying to find them and trying to bring them to the United States. And I found in the archives just the paperwork he had submitted, kind of begging various Soviet officials to please like give his wife an exit visa, give his daughter an exit visa. And I think there is a way in which I can feel that, I mean, he died when I was 3 years old, so I don't know him. I don't have any memories of him, but I feel like the foundation of my life is built on that love that he showed by so being so steadfast in his commitment to his family. Like, so much of what I have is because of what he was able to do for them. And I feel that, and I see that in my life in a way that I never would have been able to had I not done this book, of just sort of knowing the sacrifices that people made for you before you were born, before you were even an idea. Like, had no idea that he would have like a great granddaughter that would be kind of embarking on something like this, or like living in this kind of like full, you know, American life. But he was doing as much as he could to sort of give those possibilities to his children, to his grandchildren, and, you know, to subsequent generations. And I feel the benefits of that in my own life in this way that I think is really beautiful. It doesn't exactly speak to resilience, but is something that for me has been so important coming out of this project.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place to end, I think. I mean, on love, it conquers all. Megan, thanks so much for talking with me today and about your new book, Ukraine is Not Dead Yet, A Family Story of Exile and Return. Pick it up now. Give it a read. It's a great book. Megan, thanks again for joining me.
Thank you, John.